presentation coming from the Department of Mineral Energy on the National Energy Bill. That's the official schedule for today. I am reliably informed that there is a presence of a community which is it's called Imiza Moyetu Community Group. It's supported by the Energy Research Center. So I'm sure that we will give them an opportunity as soon as the presentation is done. So we just want to apologize for the confusion, because initially we were told that we are going to have an opportunity of the department making a presentation on national energy bill. So whatever confusion you say, our humble apologies. So what I will do without much ado is to request members to introduce themselves, members of parliament, and from there we will request the department and the leader of the delegation to introduce the delegation. The other presentation which will come after this one, introductions will be done accordingly at the time those presentations start. But for now, let's have members of parliament present themselves, introducing themselves.
Well, my name is Hannes Kombrink, and I'm a member of the ANC and a committee member of the Minerals and Energy Committee.
Hi, I'm Lance Trailing. I'm a member of parliament for the Independent Democrat and obviously also a member of the Minerals and Energy Committee.
Eric Lucas, member of the committee.
Themba Mahlaba, ilunga laleli committee elimelwe ANC.
Chris Molefe, member of this committee from the ANC.
I did introduce myself, isn't it? Opam Naren, the whip of the committee, portfolio committee from the ANC.
It's Peter Fordham Bailey, committee secretary.
And from there we can have the department with the introduction.
Thank you, Chairperson. From the department, there is three of us. My name is Santa Kumede. I'm the Deputy Director General for Hydrocarbons Energy Planning. And I'm joined by Jeff Subramani on the other side, who is the Director Energy Planning, and myself also called to Director Compliance and Monitoring. And I'd like to also perhaps the State Law Advisor introduce him.
Hala Sangoni from the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor.
Well, thank you, Chairperson. My name is Munda Mukwena. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the National Energy Regulator, and I'm here present as an observer. Thank you.
Is there any other person who has not introduced himself in this process, coming from the department or observing? Well, without much ado, can we have the department starting with its presentation? The process will be simple. You go through your presentation, and members will do as they normally do, ask questions after presentation.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honorable members. Good morning. Today, I guess, is the official briefing by the department on the briefing the committee on the National Energy Bill.
the version that is that people would have, or the presentation is based on the gazetted version of the bill, which is B-52 of 2008. As the bill was introduced into the National Assembly under Section 75 of the Act. Chairperson, I'll start a little bit back and talk a little bit about... by the way, Chair, I do assume you've got a presentation in front of you. It is a lengthy presentation. What I've attempted to do is to extract all the sections, the key sections of the Act, and they will appear in the presentation itself. But clearly, in some cases, the wording, the detailed wording, could still exist in the bill, and I'll be referencing between the bill and the presentation itself. But the bill was introduced in 2003, and the essence thereof was, at that time, all the other bills, other than the Electricity Regulation Act, had actually been promulgated. At the time, we had on the hydrocarbon side, for instance, we already had the Petroleum Products Act adopted, had been to Parliament. We had already had the Gas Act. We already had the Petroleum Products Act had been presented to Parliament. And you had a whole number of energy-related pieces of legislation, as envisaged by the Energy White Paper, that have already been presented to Parliament that far. Cabinet approved a process for public consultation in 2004, and the bill itself was then widely consulted in 2004. It was, however, when it was then reintroduced in 2006, because of certain things that happened in 2006, some of which the chairperson would remember, shortages in terms of liquid fuels, shortages in electricity, there was a greater focus on the concept of energy security. It is only at that stage that then the bill was then withdrawn, such that it will then... We thought that there was a glaring opening in respect of energy security. So the bill itself focuses largely on energy security, even though almost all of it is informed by the Energy White Paper of 1998. Because it's informed by the Energy White Paper of 1998, that presents certain challenges. The challenge being that the White Paper on energy policy is 10 years old and is up for a review. And that process of reviewing the energy bill was started with an energy summit last year in September, with the view that there will be a formal engagement process on the policy paper itself that will go to regions and which will then formally go into the NEDLAR process. However, it then raises the question on whether do we wait for another 2 years with the process of finalizing whatever might have been required by the Energy White Paper, the White Paper on Energy Policy, or do we continue? And the view, Chairperson, was one that says the Energy White Paper, in terms of the principles that govern the Energy White Paper and the objectives of the Energy White Paper, I think they were reaffirmed by those at least who attended the Energy Summit, that the objectives of the Energy White Paper are still very much relevant. However, there are certain things that have changed, because the Energy White Paper itself is underpinned by a number of assumptions, some of which are no longer valid. For instance, the Energy White Paper assumed that energy security is the only reference to energy security, is that it can be, or security of energy as it's called, security of energy supply, focus on security of energy supply, is that it can be achieved through greater the diversification and flexibility of supply. It says the energy sector shall rely on market-based pricing. The energy white paper placed a greater emphasis on commercialization and competition. It, however, acknowledged that competitive energy markets do need some form of sophisticated regulatory regime. It was, I guess, on that basis, Chairperson, that the government embarked on a number of processes to develop its regulatory regime. The Energy White Paper assumed that government will only promote investment in the energy sector. I'm thinking about something else. This one is about, it says, it assumes that government will promote investment into the sector itself, instead of seeing energy as a vehicle to drive investment in other sectors of the economy. The Energy White Paper assumed that there is a healthy balance between the interest of capital, the investors, and national objectives, that those two will always go in tandem. The Energy Paper also does state that experiences in other competitive markets have shown that markets work well in a situation of overcapacity. It is therefore, I guess, Chairperson, no coincidence that at the time in 1998, the country had overcapacity both in the electricity sector and in the petroleum sector. We had capacity at the refinery level, we had capacity at Eskom. And therefore, the assumption that underpinned the Energy White Paper was perhaps of a sustained overcapacity. Therefore, in the drafting of the bill, the validity of some of these assumptions which are underpinning the policy were a concern. I just thought, Chairperson, I'll also just indicate, as the Chair would know, that in the 90s, the World Bank, for instance, was one that said the state should not participate in the productive sector. The state was supposed to facilitate investment, but the state does not participate. It was happening listening to a director from the World Bank at the recent conference, at AFRILA conference in Cancun, who made a statement that is an official World Bank statement that says privatization is not a panacea. The role of both public and the private sector, there is a role for both the public and the private sector in energy investment, as well as he made other comments. I think, Chairperson, I also just wanted to indicate as we start making the presentation that the Energy Bill does not seek to replace any other piece of legislation that the Department has put through this committee over years. It interfaces with most of those legislations. It establishes links between between energy and environment, and energy and it establishes links between energy and environment and energy and the general economy, and the role it establishes link between the role that energy plays in addressing poverty, both energy poverty and poverty in general. I've just indicated here with a list of pieces of legislation that have gone through this committee, Chairperson, the Electricity Regulation Act, which regulates the electricity supply industry. This bill does not touch that. It does not seek to address electricity supply issues. The Gas Act, all the gas issues there, transport, whatever, the Petroleum Products Act and everything that goes with it, empowerment, industrial structural issues, the Central Energy Fund Act of 1977, the MPRDA, which deals with the ownership of minerals and the permits and rights, the Petroleum Pipelines Act, which deals with the regulation of the petroleum pipelines industry, the setting of tariffs and ensuring access to storage facilities and storage and pipelines, the Electricity Distribution Industry Restructuring Bill, which was meant to serve in this committee, the Standards Act, and NEMA. The list is not intended to be exhaustive, Chairperson. I'm just trying to indicate that the bill itself is impacted on and impacts on a number of other pieces of legislation. Just as an indication again, Chairperson, I just wanted to also, as setting the scene, to indicate that what most of these bills are really about, as I call them there, they're really about dealing with the past and the present. I guess to some extent, in respect of licensing, there is a future. The National Energy Bill is, in its essence, about the future. The Energy Bill is about securing energy future. That's what the bill is about. Whilst the other pieces of legislation would deal in the main with issues of governance, redress, pricing, all the competition issues. So it's about competition. The other bills, like for instance the Petroleum Products Act or the Electricity Regulation Act, it's about competition and industrial structure. It's about economic issues, which is about prices and tariffs. They are about standards and specifications, quality of supply, health and safety, social and national objectives, and industry structuring and restructuring. That's what those acts in the main are about. Whilst the Energy Bill is about, because it focuses on the future, it's about data and information, it's about modeling and planning, it's about future fuels, sustainable access, maintaining affordability, research, climate change, and security of supply. But to put it in context, Chairperson, as I've said, in the main, the bill is premised on the Energy White Paper, the White Paper on Energy Policy of 1998. However, there are some aspects of the bill which really use the Energy Security Master Plan as the basis. And the start of the Energy Security Master Plan is that it defines energy security, which, Chairperson, is always important to read it different from saying it's security of energy, security of energy supply. It covers security of supply, but in its context, it's important to understand that energy security is bigger than supply. Energy security is bigger than what people might call reserve margins or strategic stocks. It is bigger than that. It talks to issues of local production. It talks to issues of the interface between energy policy and foreign policy. It talks to issues of climate change, which is about mitigation and adaptation. It talks to issues of standards and specifications, because that affects consumption levels. It also affects issues of emission. You cannot ignore the issues of specifications and standards. It's also because of globalization, it talks to issues of interface with other economies in the world. It talks also, it begins to talk to a key important issue, which is the role of the state in the productive sector.
It talks to you, yes, of course, to diversity of supply, as was what was the premise in respect of the white paper on energy policy. It talks to import and export policies, but it understands that all that we do exists within a macroeconomic framework. For instance, on issues of beneficiation, if this economy wants to beneficiate its minerals, there is an understanding and a requirement that there should be an understanding that the Chairperson, could I ask, the cell phones are a bit distraction.
I'm sure that you are going to be mindful of the fact that communities are interacting with parliament. So communities are not conversant of processes in parliament.
Okay.
So I will ask communities to respect processes. It's difficult, I know. Phones are very sophisticated. So the best thing, if you don't know how to put them on silent, you switch them off. So as we can proceed in a manner befitting parliament. I'm sure with the Abu Mama Nuzwinde, ne? Yes, I'm sure with the Alphalama phone, the Wazuk Nalela, because when you make a presentation, I'm going to want to be stepping, ne? Thank you very much. You are protected by the chair.
Thanks, Chairperson. Chairperson, I was still just saying that it's important to understand that the macroeconomic framework also define an energy security in respect of if this economy wants to beneficiate its minerals, there should be a clear understanding that the energy intensity of this economy will increase. Because to process chromium oxide, there is no other way of processing chrome but to actually run electricity through it. To produce zinc, to produce all of the minerals to process further all the minerals that this country has in abundance, you need to have a lot of energy. But the decision, therefore, this economy would have to make is whether it wants to beneficiate its minerals or it doesn't. I'm just citing one example, Chairperson, that in terms of macroeconomic policy, that energy security is impacted. But in terms of energy security, clearly we have to begin to do energy research. We have to have an intensive program looking at research in terms of how energy, both in terms of technologies, production technologies, types of fuel, and also in terms of appliances that are used by energy. It's got to look at demand management. In demand management, we're talking about energy efficiency. We're talking about conservation. We're talking about... So it's really about understanding demand and also then making sure that in demand management, you're also talking about ensuring that the appropriate energy carriers are used for appropriate applications. As part of it, and this is what happened in 2005, what continues to happen, I guess, in the moment, is that it is important to focus on the production capacity of energy carriers, Chairperson. We need to be able to think also more broadly about energy infrastructure and think about how you actually get the energy to where it's required. So it talks to energy security, talks to energy infrastructure planning. But clearly, it also talks to the insurance, which is what we call the reserve margin. It clearly talks to the insurance, because the reserve margin is nothing but an insurance. It's not electricity that you use on a day-to-day basis, nor is it liquid fuels that you're supposed to use on a day-to-day basis, but it's what you keep in reserve in the event that one of your production plants were to ever go down, or one of your lines that you are transmitting on were to ever go down. That's what you keep in store, but that's insurance. But unfortunately, Chairperson, it comes at a cost, like any other insurance. And of course, it talks to local production. So it's important, Chairperson. I'm just wanting to raise this issue at the beginning, Chairperson, just so that we are all in understanding that this bill, in the main, is about those issues. It is not about pricing necessarily. But in the definition of energy security, which I'll come to, Chairperson, because it's defined, the definition of energy security is captured in the object of this act. There is an issue about price. Therefore, the Chairperson, this bill is, in essence, is about five things. It's about data and information, energy data and information. It is about modeling and planning, and we differentiate between the two, modeling and planning, and I will talk to that, Chairperson. It's about development, energy development, as I've indicated. It's about renewable and future energies. It's about efficiency, in both in production and in use of energy. It's about coordinated research on both carriers and technology. It's about security of supply, both in respect of carriers themselves and also in terms of feedstock. It's that insurance I spoke of. And it's about state participation in key energy infrastructure planning and development. As a start, Chairperson, there's an indication that the energy bill, as I've indicated, it seeks to create certain institutions, but it does not seek to replace any, but to strengthen them, with an understanding that energy is the lifeblood of any economy. And that, unfortunately, economic decisions which are made without due regard of the availability of energy and the price thereof are problematic. And therefore, the bill itself focuses on issues which are intended to strengthen energy security. But as a start, it begins to say, let's collect proper data and facilitate the sharing thereof. You don't have this slide in your presentation, but it just as an afterthought, I just thought it is important, Chairperson, that we always premise whatever that you do on the understanding that economies do not develop without energy. And that also the amount of energy that economies consume are a reflection on the level of development. It's those two things. And it's important also to understand, Chairperson, that whilst we're not proposing that, because for instance, when the UK industrialized in the beginning, in the 1800s, is that it used a lot of energy. But again, the technology was not available at the time, I guess, the most efficient energy. And the US did the same. Japan was the one that peaked early, but this is where the developing world is climbing. It is clear, Chairperson, that the developing world can't go to the level where the US and the UK went, because we do have issues of climate change to deal with. We do have issues of availability of energy resources to deal with. But nonetheless, it would be unfair of us to believe that when all the other developing economies, when they were industrializing, they used a lot of energy, that Africa will industrialize differently. Going into the bill itself, Chairperson, it is arranged in chapters, chapters 1 to chapter 8. I will deal with each of the chapters. In your presentation, I'll start with chapter 1, start with the long title, which I will go through in detail, because for us that's an important issue, but of course it's detailed. You have the bill, copy of the bill, but I'll highlight the key issues that we see in that long title. But it's really about three key areas, which in the presentation they are highlighted in three different colors. The first one is about diversity. It's to ensure diverse energy resources are available. Let's ensure that they are available. That's number one. It's about availability of diverse energy resources. But the key word there is that in sustainable quantities. But as indicated, different from what the other pieces of legislation governing the energy sector would talk to, this is about, it says whatever that is done, it must be affordable. This was important, I think, Chairperson, for us, that says in terms of economy, in terms of economic principles, there is no such thing as a shortage of anything. People just can't afford it. The need goes away. In terms of demand, in terms of a demand curve that is always plotted, is that as the price goes up, the amount that is demanded comes down. It doesn't mean it is not available. It is just that people can't afford it. So we wanted to have a distinct separation from that, that says it must be affordable. If it's not affordable, it is not available. As distinct from some people that might be talking about competitive, this is about affordability. It must be affordable to communities. It must be affordable to the economy. Because if it's not affordable, it is not available. So it does that in support of economic growth and poverty alleviation. But it does that taking into account environmental management requirements, international commitments and obligations, and of course, with a clear, distinct understanding that energy impacts and is impacted on by almost all economic sectors in South Africa. That's the first one, in the third part of the title. The second part is that the bill establishes, it seeks to establish institutions that are going to be responsible for a promotion of energy, of efficient, again, we focus on two, it's about efficiency, but both in the generation and in the consumption of energy. It focuses on creation of institutions. It proposes creation of an institution to deal with modeling, another institution to deal with planning. It focuses on creation of the institution to deal with the increased generation and consumption of renewable energies, energy research, and contingency in respect of energy supply, which might mean holding of strategic energy minerals. It also seeks to look at the creation of institutions that will deal with adequate investment in and an appropriate upkeep of equitable and I guess access to the energy infrastructure. It seeks to promote measures which will allow this, which one of the key measures is about access to data and information. Regarding, and that energy data and information is in respect of energy demand, in respect of energy supply and energy generation, and all the other matters that are connected therewith. That's the title, Chairperson. The definitions, I won't talk to all of them, Chairperson, but the one that I thought would be useful to talk to is the definition on energy security. We make reference to energy security, but it's defined in the Act as it means availability of diverse energy resources in sustainable quantities and at affordable prices to the South African economy in support of economic growth and poverty alleviation, whilst taking into account environmental management requirements, international commitments, and interactions amongst economic sectors. I think, Chairperson, in terms of the definitions, they are in the bill. I would not bore you with going through them one by one. I'll move on to the objects of the Act. This Act has got a few objects, but the objects are basically to, one, it's the key word here, ensure uninterruptible supply of energy to the Republic. This is the mandate of the Minister of Minerals and Energy, ensuring uninterruptible supply of energy to the Republic. This is the mandate of the Minister of Minerals and Energy. The other one is to promote diversity, both in terms of supply of energy and its sources. It's about facilitation of effective management of demand, and of course it's conservation, to promote energy research, is to promote standards, appropriate standards and specifications. We're looking at mainly in terms of energy equipment, systems and processes. It's to ensure, again one of those, ensure collection of energy data and information, collection of data and information relating to energy supply, transportation and demand, is to promote evidence-driven energy and related sector policy formulation. Next page, the objects are continue. The object of the Act, again, to promote optimal supply, and the key word there is optimal, is to promote or provide for safety, health, and environmental matters that pertain to energy, is to facilitate the improvement of the quality of life. Clearly, it's about commercialization of energy-related technologies, but it's about effective planning, and it's about sustainable development of the South African economy and to ensure fulfillment of international obligations and commitments pertaining to energy. So if you go to Chapter 2, Chapter 3 of the bill, Section 3 of the bill, it starts with this part that says the minister must prescribe. The minister must prescribe mandatory provision of any data and information that relates to for the purposes of energy modeling and planning. But it goes on to say where such data is not already made available to a state institution. So it seeks to mandate provision of data and information, but without putting, hopefully, too much burden on the providers of energy if they are already providing it to other institutions of government. It seeks to prescribe connection to any other data, to any data and information management system within the public administration. The question has always been asked, why would this be necessary? I guess for institutions, especially independent institutions within the public administration sector, ask for certain information for different purposes. And in most cases, it does that on the promise that that information will not be shared with any other person. Especially, Chairperson, for when you're setting prices, and a regulator that sets prices for certain companies in a particular sector, they clearly would like to keep to you as a regulator to give you as little information as possible in respect of their profitability. Because when they come to negotiate for the margin increase, you don't want to be raising a flag and saying, how can we be talking margin increase when you've got this much of, level of profitability. However, in terms of the Revenue Act, they are supposed to still supply that information to the tax authorities. But it's not information, I'm afraid, that any other government department can easily get access to. And it's important that it's like that so that people can feel free to disclose properly for tax purposes. in terms of that connection that is then promoted, that is sought in respect of this act, it also seeks to ensure that information that is so accessed on the promise that it is protected by the Promotion of Access to Information Act, that information will not be disclosed as well. But it's also subject to the STATS Act, which also collects some information. So that's what the Chapter 2, Section 3, 1B seeks to achieve. Goes on to say, the minister may, subject to confidentiality of information, of course, permit sharing of information with any other state entity. And that information, of course, that is provided under this Act should be subject to the provisions of Access to Information Act. Chairperson, this clause is important for us in the sense that whatever information that is provided, it is important that people understand that if it's provided for energy planning purposes, which might be sometimes very sensitive, competitive information that has been provided, it is important that that information is not shared, with the competitors in that particular sector. Section 4 of the Act talks to the safety, health, and environment. Here, there is a distinct recognition, Chairperson, that this area of safety is largely, health and safety in the main, is largely a domain of the Minister of Labour. And I guess environment, health and environment is supposed to be DIT. And also trade and industry, the Minister of Trade and Industry has got an interest in this area. But there are areas in energy which are very specific to energy. That the idea, therefore, is that to make sure that all the safety and health and environmental issues emanating from energy that are better managed, that the Minister of Minerals and Energy would also have to have a role. And it says the minister may establish programs, but it's programs that are not envisaged in any other act. And also would may prescribe standards and specifications which are not elsewhere legislated or regulated. Section 5 of the Act talks about the minister may establish programs.
Let me just try to just make a small intervention. Normally, when we ask departments to send copies 7 days before, it's precisely because we want to short-circuit the process of a long input and presentation. And I'm reliably informed by the secretary that because I wanted to check, because we're on recess for a long time, when was this copy circulated to members? And I'm informed that it only came this morning. So the best thing, you see, because the program says that there should be a brief from the department. And a brief means a brief. As long as members have copies, that they can interact. Today we are not going to make any determination on the bill. We are simply going to listen to the presentation and from there interact with you through questions. But there is going to be a process unfolding. Like tomorrow we are going to have public hearings, Thursday and Tuesday. So there is going to be a benefit of the public coming on board to make input relevant to the processes of their engagement on the ground. So the best thing is to, because I can see that the presentation is very loaded, it's huge, but the bill itself is having very few pages. So what you normally do in a brief is just to
explained all the issues which are technical, which are to the public very controversial, which are not easily understood by the ordinary people on the ground. So it will be very important. I don't know if I'm fair to you, but I'm just saying that if you can concentrate on those aspects, because otherwise, again, we are guided by time. So I just want to check, because the process is between now, it was between 10 o'clock and 1. But because there is going to be another input by another stakeholder, can you assist us in that regard? So, for example, when you look into your memo, your explanatory memorandum, the memorandum captures more or less everything you seek to achieve in as far as the bill is concerned. So maybe you can take a shortcut by simply making sure that you cut it short and you make sure that it is at the salient aspect and features of the bill, and more sure some of the issues which are written in the explanatory memorandum will assist us. And from there we can get an opportunity at the committee to go through the bill itself and all the issues. And in public hearings, we'll also get an opportunity of saying what areas of concern are ordinary stakeholders and people raising. So I'm sure that I am online and trying to guide you. Are you in that position to cut it short, Chief?
Chairperson, thanks for that input. I put as much detail as I wasn't quite sure how far you might want, but the aspects of the bill are in the bill itself. I would explain the meaning of each of the chapters and what informs that, and will not go through the detail which is in the bill itself. I am in the position to that, Chair. Thank you. Members and Chair, therefore, henceforth, what I will do is I will not then go through each section. You have the copies of the bill. I will only just go through, for instance, I'll go through this one, which says, before I go to the energy modeling and data, I would like to then begin to explain the premise on which this is based. As I indicated at the beginning, all of this is based on the energy white paper. And, of course, that is not based on the energy white paper. It's based on the energy security master plan. So those are the aspects, Chairperson, but I won't go through the bill itself. But it's for those that don't have it, it is contained. The bill, some extracts of the bill are contained in the presentation. When we look at energy data and energy modeling, and, of course, to ask what informs the bill in respect, what in terms of the bill in respect of energy data and energy modeling? If you look at page 19 of the Energy White Paper, it says, for the various reasons, South Africa has limited, this is 1998, it recognized that South Africa has limited energy data, and furthermore, very limited capacity to perform this form of policy analysis. Page 81 says, informed decision making at all levels is only possible when suitable and credible statistics and information are available. I'm linking this to the aspect in the Act where we talk about, when we talk about that, the decision making. The white paper talks a lot about the renewable energies. There's currently a national lack of renewable energies, energy data and information on renewable energy systems and applications, system specifications, system standards, installation and performance guides, and many other related issues. The Energy White Paper goes on to say government will establish suitable information systems on renewable energy statistics where justifiable and will assist in the dissemination thereof. Page 84 of the white paper says
that the government will ensure that necessary resources are available to establish structures and systems and put in place legislation to ensure that there is acquisition, there's collection, acquisition, storage, maintenance, and supply of energy data and energy-related data in accordance to the requirements of integrated energy planning and international standards. Page 84, Chairperson, I'll leave the detail, it's in the presentation. Page 84 says the data should be collected and stored in accordance with international specifications and standards to facilitate easy comparison, integration, and exchange. So in the bill, we make reference to that. We make reference to the connectivity and exchange. This is where it comes from. And it then goes on to say data should be collected regularly and database kept up to date. The problem, Chairperson, in collection of data is that it's a very people-intensive process, very expensive process, and once you start on it, you've got to do it on a yearly basis, or it becomes a fruitless exercise. Or at least on a regular basis, not so much on a year basis, but on a regular basis. Some data is we need to have weekly data. In some cases, you might want to have daily data. But it then goes on to say in page 90 that the Department of Mineral Energy will include explicit environmental considerations into the studies regarding energy supplies and users and integrate those results through integrated energy planning. Chairperson, I just thought at this stage it would be important for the committee to understand, as we said, that there's a difference between, there are three distinct points. First thing is about collection of data, and we see once you have the data, it's important that you then separate between modeling and planning. Those are three distinct things. In the next page, Chairperson, we talk about the differences what we see between modeling and planning. And we also think, Chairperson, there is merit in that this is not housed in one individual or one component of government or one agency or whatever, because it's conflicting. And I'll talk to planning in detail but later. But looking at modeling, the way we say it is that modeling is not supposed to prescribe things, and it should avoid advocating any policy. Modeling is about setting what is. It's about explaining and defining what is. While planning, on the other side, it's about distinct policy choices. It's about making deliberate policy choices. So, and we therefore see these two things as, while important, they complement each other. They are different. On the next slide, Chairperson, and this is referenced in the Energy White Paper, that in terms of plans, for instance, ESCOM, NERSA, Department of Transport, everyone develops their own plan, whether they are strategic plans or investment plans or whatever plans, everyone comes up with their plan. The planning itself tends to be devolved. It tends to happen at different places. That's where the problem lies. There is no integration of all those plans. Everyone simply assumes that the cake is available for me and me alone, when in actual fact the cake has to be shared, and be shared equitably amongst all those that are users of energy. And also, anyway, even making those decisions on what type of energy that is required, it also presents problems. So we basically see an integration, a link between the planning, and we would like to say that there's got to be some kind of linkages when people are developing plans, which they should develop, when individual government entities are developing plans, that there is a link with energy modeling, that there is a that those talk to each other. And that, of course, the sum total of all of these plans needs to all come up and come into what is then would then be called an integrated energy plan, which must be developed through means of coordination, some kind of central coordination. Whether Chairperson you call it central planning or whatever, but then there's got to be some kind of coordination that ensures that each of the plans at least begin to talk to each other. And Chairperson, yes, there have been comments around whether we're still looking at the supply side. The Energy White Paper is very specific. It says this plan should commence with demand side analysis. So you understand how the energy, what kind of energy is demanded, what is supposed to be used for, and you using that through integrated energy planning or through planning, you then supposed to look at how best to supply the energy that is required, both now and into the future. But with a distinct understanding that energy is not an end good, but it is rather consumed as a means to an end. But to do that, page 6 of the Energy Bill, again, as I want to say, stress again, it understands that to do or that a demand side, a demand led planning, this requires a great deal of data and analysis to implement. Page 82, details energy planning. Chairperson, I'm not going to talk to the issues there, but the energy planning, whatever and modeling that is proposed, can be linked directly to what has been extracted from page 82 of the Energy White Paper, which is about national economic and social and environmental policies. It's about energy supply systems and demand side management. It's about analyzing energy sector linkages to the macro economy. It's about the global and technological developments and the effects of legislative, institutional, and industry structure. And it specifies sourcing and presentation of data, both on the supply and demand side. What was of interest, Chairperson, I think I'm talking a bit about the energy planning part, is the last part on the next slide. Page 82 of the White Paper on Energy Policy states that in the electricity sector case, the National Electricity Regulator, now the National Energy Regulator, will only license new facilities upon satisfactory completion of an integrated resource plan. And the Act envisages that the NERSA or the National Energy Regulator will develop that resource plan. That's on page 82 of the Energy White Paper. So on page 84, again, it details what information is required. It's about resources, all energy resources, it's about the production side from indigenous resources. It's about international trade. It's issues of energy transformation. It talks to storage, whatever. It talks to national energy trade. It talks to investments in plant and infrastructure and energy efficiency, energy-related environmental emissions. So it's all of those types of data that the Energy White Paper envisages needs to be collected. To do this, Chairperson, we're proposing and we are in the process of developing a national integrated energy modeling system, which is in front of you, Chairperson, and it's a modular design. It looks at demand sectors, and within those sectors, it subdivides those sectors. It does not assume that the residential sector is one big blob. It does understand that you've got the rural sector, the urban sector. Within that, you also have rich, middle income, poor, and no income people. And the approach to energy provision for each one of that can't be the same. And the impact of energy policies and programs on each one of those can't be the same. It looks at the supply sectors, which is oil and gas, clearly nuclear or uranium, but nuclear fuels, coal supply. We've added water supply because, unfortunately, in the production of energy, you need a lot of water in most of the processes. And South Africa is a water-scarce country. It looks, it's got a renewable fuel module. But it specifically looks at the conversion sectors and infrastructure, which are related to electricity, petroleum, and energy that's used directly. It focuses, got a module that looks specifically on climate change issues, international energy and macroeconomic activity. I won't talk in detail, Chairperson, some of these things, just to indicate, because each time we talk about modeling and we see we place a lot of value in the collection of the data, but that data in itself means nothing unless it's actually put it's put out in a manner which people can consume. Data is just numbers. And numbers would not have no meaning unless there is value add which is done on them. And that's where the modeling comes in. So to do that, say we require a model that can forecast as well as explain energy policy impacts on the economy, focusing on key government concerns, which are relating to inflation, to unemployment, taxes, government spending, and trade. This is not an exhaustive thing. It's a whole lot of others. And you need a most of the models that we possibly have just merely assumes that if you've got the sun, you know, in terms of its load factor, you can convert the energy of the sun 100% into energy. Unfortunately, that is, you know, it's important that we need to have energy models that begin to explain technology and focuses on the energy use within each sector. And of course, clearly there is the issue of what is called the adjustment cost or switching cost, that if another form of energy becomes available and it's cheap, there is always a cost of switching because you probably have a particular appliance already, and to shift from one appliance to the other, that comes at a cost. So in terms of the proposed energy modeling, is that we're looking at something that represents energy supply, conversion, and demand in a unified but modular system, something that details, that's got a detailed structural and process model, and is typically bottom-up. And what we mean by typically bottom-up modeling is one where we are saying I've just been asked to speed through this. So you all have the issue around models. It's important that you understand when we're talking, we make insinuations around modeling, and it's important to understand what we mean by that. And the difference between the general type modeling and what is meant in here. So I'll keep most of this. I thought I'll talk slightly about all of these models and what kind of information. Also, I thought it would be important for stakeholders to understand when we, because there is concern in terms of what kind of data we'd be looking for. I'm hoping that this will begin to indicate what kind of data that would be required for energy modeling. I've talked in detail about planning, I think. I thought that I'll then talk about energy efficiency slightly, that the Energy White Paper deals with energy efficiency in detail. There are lots of references to energy efficiency, but the point that I wanted to raise here
is one that says, on page 15 of the Energy White Paper, it says, government will investigate the establishment of an appropriate institutional infrastructure and capacity for the implementation of energy efficiency strategies. That's number one. And it defines what that agency, in terms of, on page 87 of the Energy White Paper, it defines what that agency should do, which is about building consumer awareness, demonstrating benefits to consumers, building capacity for targeted efficiency programs, training people, and identifying barriers to energy efficiency. And the NUI paper talks to energy research. But again, the one point I wanted to raise here is that Energy White Paper sees the role of government as facilitating energy research rather than participating in energy research. And then on renewables, it talks again. There's the Energy White Paper is littered with references to renewables, the least cost energy services approach, though. It talks about appropriate standards and codes of practice. But on page 29, it talks about investigation of an environmental levy on energy sales to fund the development of renewables. Chairperson, the rest of it is in the pack, and also it's extracted from the Act itself. So I think the one thing that I'd like to talk to you lastly, Chairperson, is energy supply, security of energy supply. Energy White Paper is almost silent on security of supply, except that it says as objective 5 of that of the White Paper is that it seeks to secure supply through diversity. However, it says there are concerns about the ability of the competitive market to ensure sustained investment and security of supply at low prices in the long run. Chairperson, with that, I think I'll come to the end of my presentation. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much, I'm going to now afford an opportunity to members to ask questions such that we give the department an opportunity to respond.
Thank you, Chair. It's a very, very long presentation, but it's also very, if you start reading it and you go through all these documents, you realize it's very hard work you put into it, and I want to thank you for it. Firstly, I just want to make sure, did the bill make enough provision for public participation in civil society? Because it's very important that, especially, you bring public, but you must also bring the big oil companies, the big mine companies, everyone together to start talking about it. Did this bill also help, or this act help with energy safety education? Because I saw in some of the presentations of tomorrow, it's a big issue about education, especially when it comes to energy safety. One thing really worries me is, what is the role of provincial and local government? Because we make sometimes very nice bills and acts here of national level, but when it ends up in provincial and local government, it is not so very well controlled. Did we make provision for new technologies and ventures like solar powers, like nuclear?
I know lands don't like nuclear, but
it's also very important. How did the South African National Energy Development Institute relate to SANERI and NEA, or is it disbanding, or is it near, SANERI and NEA going to stop after this act? Climate change is this morning all over the cabinet make new plans regarding climate change. Fossil fuels like coal, are we bringing coal also in as an energy resource? Because you're talking about solar power, water supply, but as we need water supply, we also need coal. Is coal also part of your plan? And lastly, you're talking about a 25-year plan, but then also in the same sentence you said it is to revise it every year. So I just want to, you must explain to me, you mean you have a plan for 25 years, but then every year you're going to change it, or how it's going to work. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I mean, I echo the sentiments of my colleague, Honourable Combrink. As I said, when you gave us the trailer, I think it was about 6 months ago, when you said you were bringing this for, I said I was very excited by that, because I think it is desperately needed. One of the things that's unclear, though, to me, and I'm not going to speak to some of the specifics of the bill, because I think we'll go into those details as we go into the process. One of the things that's unclear to me is how this links up with the other type of energy planning processes that other departments and other entities engage in. So, for instance, we hear it announced that 1.3 trillion rand will be spent over the next 25 years on building new energy generation in South Africa. Now, this is largely coming from Eskom, and they've already announced their plans as to what they intend to spend that money on, such as 6 nuclear reactors, certain coal-fired power stations and that. The issue that I'm asking specifically is that we've seen these kind of figures put forward and we've seen these plans put forward. To what extent does this influence those particular decisions? Because, I mean, we've already seen that the first contract for the nuclear power plant is being finalized, I think, within the next month or so. So to what extent is the decisions being made by other entities being impacted upon by the work that this particular bill and this particular institute that you're setting up have on it? Because when I look at your integrated energy planning section, it says that... it says, it must have a plan horizon of 25 years, but it also says that it must guide energy plans. I think I can't find the exact phrase yet. But it says it must act as a guide. So it doesn't have specific authority to indicate that this is the way that the country should be moving and must be moving. So essentially it does still give leeway to other entities to make those decisions unilaterally. I mean, I just want you to clarify that specifically as to how much authority these particular integrated energy master plans will have over the plans and the actual decisions of other entities. Because I think it is an important prescription that we need to look at. And then just lastly, in terms of what the objectives of the Act are, when we look at energy planning, I think that the other thing that we need to bring in here, which possibly is covered, but that maybe needs to be more explicitly stated, is that if we're going to be spending 1.3 trillion rand over the next 25 years, this is, to my mind, probably the largest public procurement the government's ever undertaken on anything. And now, we need to make sure, not only in terms of that we're going to get energy at the end of the day, but also that we're going to be creating the maximum amount of jobs out of that particular public procurement, and also in terms of balance of payments as well. We don't want all of that money going overseas to fund other companies. We want to make sure that we are actually funding our own companies and keeping that money in South Africa. So I think that is an important consideration to be taken into account when looking at energy planning. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. A similar question, Jack, where you spoke about where you correctly said if we need to beneficiate, energy is going to be important. Then you spoke about the white paper and said that the white paper's approach is that there should be investment. Something is just not clear to me according to this bill, because like people are talking about 1 trillion in 25 years of 340 billion in 5 years. And if you look at the country's budget, it is about 350, the whole budget. Now, if only for electricity, you have to spend 340 within 5 years. Obviously, that is beyond our budget. Now, in this bill, you spoke about investment. I'm not sure. I'm just saying, where is this money going to come? Where exactly is this money going to come from? And if it comes from, if we expect private enterprise to help, can we rely on them? And won't that raise the cost of electricity to an extent that it doesn't become affordable? Just if that point of whether all this money is going to come from is clarified.
Yeah, the point I wanted to raise is that members should be careful to not to raise issues. Some of the issues are raised by ESCOM, and some of the issues are raised by the department in as far as the bill is concerned. So the issues around the 1.3 trillion are actually issues which projections which were made by ESCOM in solving the energy crisis in South Africa. So I'm sure that if the department has a know-how on how to manage that and how to raise that money, then they can answer that question. But if they don't have the know-how, then it's a problem. But I just want to say that are members satisfied with questions? Is there any member want to ask other questions? Honorable Lucas?
Yes, thank you, Chairman. I was just the issue that sometimes we forget when we talk about pricing. Climate change in the first world countries, America, the United Kingdom, Europe, did the bulk of the damage because there were no restrictions. Now, those of us that are coming in now at this hour, we always said, oh, you've got the cheapest electricity, but you forget that we have to pay for the environment, we've got to pay all these added costs, which makes it expensive. And we compare it with people in the first world who have done all the damage. And that worries me tremendously. And I think at the end of the day, it's the poor person who has to foot the bill for all this.
May I ask the department to respond to the question? Thanks.
Thanks, Chairperson. Another member, comrade, asked a number of very detailed questions. The first one, Chairperson, is about the public participation in respect of this bill. We, prior to the bill being published or gazetted, the detailed wording, that is the bill itself, there has been previous versions of the bill which has been out today in the market, as I've indicated, Chairperson, from 2003. But in this particular version of the bill, the wording itself became available when the bill was certified, after the bill was certified by the State Law Advisor. But prior to it serving to Cabinet, there has been a number of discussions on a number of consultation processes with the, well, we're not sure whether to call it consultation, because some people perhaps would say consultation is only at NEDLAC, but we've had a number of public processes, which again were held in Pretoria, properly advertised, but again, it's about the reach. Whether, if the question from Member Combrick is whether we, was there a process of moving, for instance, from region to region to communicate or to engage with stakeholders, and the answer to that is no, but there was a public engagement processes at the DME. We were, of course, hoping that the parliamentary process itself would allow for an even better and more effective
engagement, because it would then be based on the bill itself. So I'm not sure whether I'm answering the question fully, but the honourable member will have to bear with me in the sense that until the bill was published was actually certified or had been to cabinet, it could not be, unfortunately, be circulated for comment. We have had also official engagements with the committee on this bill. We have talked about the principles of governing the bill, the necessity for the bill. I think on at least a couple of times now. The energy safety education. The bill calls for minister having. It calls for that the minister should be able to prescribe. Must be able to prescribe program. Firstly, must be able to prescribe standards and specifications. That is section 4.2 of the bill. And also section 4.1 of the bill talks to programs to minimize negative safety impacts of energy carriers. There are a number of those. Paraffin, we all know the impact of paraffin on communities, is a classical example. But it's not just paraffin. There's a whole host of other carriers that have particular impact on communities. And the energy bill envisages, it doesn't specifically indicate which program, but it empowers the Minister of Minerals and Energy to embark on such programs which are intended to address safety issues, both in terms of educating the public, but also in embarking on a particular program to ensure elimination or reduction of the impact of energy carriers. The role of provincial and local government. I guess, Honorable Chair, this is a bit difficult for me. I would assume that this being a Section 75 bill, it does come with, but the issue is about engagement. It's about, sorry, Chairperson. He went out to phone the DG and he didn't switch off the phone. Okay. The role of provincial and local governments, I think really it's governed by all the other intergovernmental relations, and but there's clearly, when whatever programs that are put forward, there's got to be local and provincial government participation therein. Does the bill provide for new energy technology? Clearly, what the bill envisages is that on two fronts. On the energy research side, there is an understanding that in terms of securing the future of energy, all governments need to make investments in future energy technologies, maybe even in future energy fuels, even biofuels, for instance, because bioenergy could well be the next generation, but perhaps not based on the first generation crops, perhaps on second and third generation crops. But governments need to make investments in that. There is, however, always an expectation by governments the private sector will do that, which might be, you know, a fair expectation in the sense that the people that will benefit from such technologies would be private sector, but private sector is in the business of making money. In actual fact, as indicated in the conference attended yesterday, if you are in business and you're not in the business of making money, you should not be in business. It's unfortunate. That's the issue about private sector. So the government needs to invest in new energy technology, both in terms of fuel and also in terms of the
of the appliances or equipment that use energy, to make it more efficient, the ones that uses current energy carriers, but to also come up with new ones that will perhaps use future energy sources. The relationship with Sanedi, there is a section in the bill in chapter 5. It deals specifically with Saneri and section 23(1) of the Act talks specifically about NEA, the National Energy Efficiency Agency, and Saneri, both entities which were created by a directive by the Minister of Minerals and Energy, directive that a minister can issue on SAF under the SAF Act. But it create both those directives created these entities as PTY Limited. They didn't create them as an institute. They created them as entities that are self-generating income. It also didn't create, the directives don't create these entities such that you can be able to transfer public funds into them, because there is no appropriate governance structure. Which, because for an entity to be able to, for the Minister of Finance to be able to transfer money, either the money is classified under DORA or whatever the Division of Revenue Act, is classified as transferred to private entities or transferred to SOEs or transferred to departments or provinces. So this particular one, these entities are not listed under the PFMA, so there is no facility to transfer money to them. And it is understood, Chairperson, that for the energy efficiency program that we need to undertake in electricity, for instance, we need to actually have the state begin to fund that program. So there's going to be money that has to be transferred from the fiscus for these energy efficiency programs. But you can't transfer it to NEA as it exists, because it's not listed under the PFMA, the Public Finance Management Act, as a schedule. There are a number of schedules there at the back of that act. So what this act begins to do, it does not create a new entity. It consolidates these two entities into one entity, but that are properly and legally constituted.
Those entities, did they cease to exist as private entities by virtue of this the amalgamation of this act?
Correct, Chairperson. So the entity,
comrade, is that your understanding? What is
yeah. So what essentially, but it does provide for transitional, for instance, for the staff and the liabilities and the assets of these entities. They are all covered in respect of Section 23 of the Act, or of the Bill. The issue of climate change, Honourable Member Kombek, I didn't quite, get the question there, what your question was on the climate change. But on the next question, on fossil fuels is called a key part of this. South Africa does not have much in the way of water. If we had water to the extent that Norway and Brazil and places like that have, or even the Congo, we probably would be sitting pretty well. Fortunately, South Africa is also not blessed with oil, nor is it blessed with gas. South Africa has coal. South Africa has uranium. So clearly, those two sources on the supply side play, we even have a particular coal supply module, that's in terms of the modeling itself. But in terms of the plans, again, I'll deal with the issues around the plans, especially the question asked by Honourable Member Kreiling on the plans developed by other state entities. But we can't see plans, energy plans, that do not include coal. Whether it's coal
that is used for electricity generation or coal that is used for liquid fuels generation. The coal has to play a role. Yes, in whatever that coal plays a role, it needs to take into account climate change. How you do that, whether you sequestrate the carbon or whatever the processes that might have to be coupled with the use of coal, but our plans, our energy plans, would be very short-sighted and incomplete if they ignored coal. Coal is the one resource that we have. I guess the other people might argue we've got the sun, which is true. So we do have the sun, we do have the coal, we do have coal, and it's about how then do you best utilize what we have to service the economy and to alleviate poverty. The 25-year plans, Honorable Chair, they relate to, again I'm going to link it to the question asked by Honorable Member Hwelling around the creation of jobs linked to this large public sector procurement. That if you are in the public domain, if you're in the private sector and you're looking for entrepreneurial opportunities, what you look for is you look for whether you are into supply of particular goods or services, or you are into when you are a contractor. You look for opportunities and plan ahead, and such plans are not necessarily just about intended, should not just be about servicing or for us to give us an idea when are we going to get a new refinery, so when are we going to, issues of balance of payment, for instance, in terms of the global issues in South Africa, where it's about employment. But it's also about whoever seeks to supply a particular service, you begin to plan your capacity accordingly. To say, if you know, for instance, that Eskom is going to be coming up and putting in so many OCGTs, open cycle gas turbines, you begin to say to yourself, is there space for me to begin, or is there enough procurement spent to justify a plant in South Africa to manufacture turbines? But you can't do that for one contract. It does not make sense. But if you've got a long-term view, a 25-year view, and also some kind of indication that in 2015 this plant is going to come on stream, 2020 this plant is going to come on stream, it begins to allow you to plan your capacity as an industry, all of the industries, to ask the question, should I manufacture as GE in the US or wherever I'm manufacturing and shipping these things here? Or do I have enough demand in South Africa for the next few years to justify a plant in South Africa? You don't get that unless you publish a 25-year view. Because people do not plan capacity like that. Why do we seek an annual review? The reason for that is that sometimes we commit to building a refinery in 2018. And then the following year we decide that in actual fact we can bring back that refinery and it can now be commissioned in 2014. I'm citing a particular example. But it's only as you begin to get into the actual design stage and the pre-feasibilities and the feasibility and the design stages that you can actually begin to firm your deadline. Unfortunately, even though your supply could be shifting, demand might not. The same is true as well. The Chairperson, I can say right now that a couple of years we've been growing in terms of liquid fuels consumption, especially of diesel, by about 8% per annum. But the recent high prices of diesel, of fuel, have dampened that demand. That we've now gone back in terms of we are no longer growing in the demand as we have been. So what then you need to do is you can't therefore continually, when you do plans, you can't have a static plan. It's going to take account of the changes in the environment. So that's what the 25-year view is about. And also, and in any case, in developing a plan,
you also assume that certain technologies would be at any particular point would be ready. But in actual fact, as you come closer to the time, you realize that that technology, even though you thought it would do this well, perhaps it's going to do worse than what you thought or better than what you thought, both in terms of price and availability. So those are the kinds of things that continually you need to do when you are doing planning. You need to continually update your plan. So there is no such thing as a static plan. And then, of course, I think to deal slightly with that, I will deal differently with the ESCOM question and say, as we've indicated, that as far as we are concerned, or taking into account realities, especially where you've got private sector participation, you would know, for instance, I'll use one example, maybe let me use a state-owned entity example, that says Petro SA has an interest of building an oil refinery which will be commissioned in 2014. But that issue, even though it's been indicated that that's what they want to do, it still has to go through pre-feasibility tests and feasibilities, and it has to be taken to the board for approval. Even for a state-owned entity, it's more difficult for a non-state entity because we don't know whether that decision would be given a nod by the board or not. So once you have to, in your plans, you've got to take account of other people's plans. You are hoping that in arriving at those plans, they took account of what everyone else is doing, what the demand is, you know, they took account. That's why we then say people have to take account of what happens in the general economy, and that's what the energy modeling is about. It's about an accounting system which accounts for what happens in the general system, in the general economy. And as you make your individual plan, whether you're a Department of Transport and planning our road system or planning our rail system, take account of what happens in the other parts of the economy. But more so in the sector of energy, take account of energy, both in terms of where the energy will be available and how much will be available and what price will it be available. Because those are the things that at the end of the day will determine whether your particular mode of transport would be a successful one or not. Because, for instance, if crude does go to $500 a barrel, as has been predicted by Iran yesterday, which we all hope that it doesn't happen, but if it does go to $500 a barrel, clearly we will all have to move from cars and use something else. So you can't therefore plan your transport system and forget about the price of crude, because then your transport system is flawed. Your transport plans are flawed. But it does not mean that the Department of Management and Energy now begins to make your transport plans. No. In making those transport plans, as the Department of Transport, you need to take account of what's happening in the energy space. So, what is the Section 2, Section 3E of the Act? The one about the plans, the integrated energy plans. The issue there is that the Section 11.3E of the Act talks to the integrated energy master plan will guide and be guided by a plan. And the issue for that is that the reason why we're saying that is that at some point there needs to be an integration of all these plans. They need to come together, and people understand that each of them, each of the plans that each company or each entity makes has an influence on energy. But this the master plan is not intending to say to an ESCOM, if you want to spend 1.3 trillion rands over 25 years, you can't do that. It's not intending to say to Sasol, if you want to build a project Mafuta, a CTL in the water pack, you can't do that. it takes account all of those. And we are, as I'm also hoping, that in Sasol arriving at a decision to build a project Mafuta, it's taken account of energy and the availability of energy and also the demand pattern. Beneficiation and energy investments, where is this money going to come from? Honorable Member Kekan. Again, on this one, clearly, if the money is going to come from the state, there needs to be an understanding of there clearly needs to be an understanding of the impact of the way the reason why when we talk about energy planning or that energy modeling, we always have to have this macroeconomic thing, is that if it's money that's going to be borrowed, if all the entities in South Africa are going to be borrowing X amount, South Africa has got a particular debt capacity. And that influences our macroeconomic framework. It influences our fiscal policy, our monetary policy. So it's important, therefore, again, that because all of those things impact on the growth in GDP, the impact on the inflation of the country, the impact on issues of balance of payment and therefore the level of the rand, you need to take account of all of those things when you are actually doing energy planning, because the economy is a system. You can't look at just one part of that system to make a decision. You've got to look at it as a system in its entirety. And that's what we are trying to do here. So there could be money that could be provided in terms of FDI. There could be money that could be coming from the fiscus in terms of some of these investments. But again, we have to say, for the economy to grow, it needs to be fed. And how do you feed the economy? It's by feeding it with energy, and you have to feed it with capital, and unfortunately you've got to feed it with water as well. The issues around climate change, Prof. We should never compare ourselves with the first world. Developing economies should be more responsible than how the first world developed. The Death Valley in Brazil, those that flew in those days, so-called Death Valley, that where the smelters were, cannot clearly continue. But having said all of that, Prof, it's also important that we need to understand that economies without energy don't grow. There is a link, as people say, there's a photo that's taken from by a satellite that shows the dark continent, which is Africa, compared with all the other continents which are lit. Unfortunately, you can correlate that directly to development. So there is therefore, and also it's about what resources are available. It's easy for a country like Norway to say, all our electricity, we are a responsible country, all our electricity is generated from hydro, which is true. But then they've got lots of water. But what they don't also say is that a large part of their economy, about 42% of their GDP, comes from sale of oil to other countries. With that, Chairperson, I thank you.
Thanks. I'm sure that members are satisfied. Maybe if there are more questions, we'll ask them at some point. But what we will encourage you to do, Mr. Kanta Gumede, we'll encourage you to also, when answering questions, to consider that Masiko is there, we are missing a voice. We'll consider that Jeff is there, we are missing their voices. It's a team and it's a collective, so you answer them well. So maybe they can assist me. You see, your objects
objects of the X. They are good objects, except one. The first one, which says to ensure uninterrupted supply of energy to the Republic. I just want to check it, test it, that how, in as much as it's ideal, it's exciting, it's good, everybody will appreciate that. Uninterrupted supply of energy to the Republic. How realistic is that first object? How whether it's achievable, measurable, it's what? It's my concern. Because we introduce an act and we say this is the first object. And the South African public is watching us, listening to us, and it says that we are promising them heaven and earth. Well, 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago, there was a lot of load shedding disruptions and the like. Yeah. So not so many years ago, some few weeks ago, a few months ago, now we introduce this bill and we say the first object is to ensure uninterrupted supply of energy to the public. And you must check that you have only said that we've got a crisis. The honorable member has a problem of technology. I'm sure the department will assist him. Yeah, so we have to look in terms of economy. We have said that we've got the crisis on our coal. We do have uranium, etc. But obviously when you ensure, you give this assurance to the public, you must know how is this uninterrupted supply is going to happen. The other objects for me, they are more sound and realistic, and I'm sure that I agree and concur. So maybe in your own conceptualization, you can give an explanation to this committee and give to the public such that we achieve, if we say it's attainable, it's achievable, it's measurable, it's objective, what the empirical evidence we have to say to promise everybody that this object, or whether we're talking about the ideal, maybe 30-30, not immediately, or some time to come. DDG and the team, only around that issue.
Chairperson, thanks. Firstly, I will engage my colleagues. You would know, Chairperson, I've been going around with my chief director energy planning on this issue, who unfortunately is at NEDLAC today. So, yeah, but the intention is not to engage with my colleagues, but we engage on the side.
But I think, Chair, you've raised a key issue, Section 2A of the Act. And it's about whether that should read promote, as some people have indicated, and that should read ensure. Chair, the question I'm going to ask, if the Minister of Minerals and Energy does not become accountable for continued supply of energy into this economy, who will? We didn't take lightly that word, but it is the responsibility of the Minister of Minerals and Energy to ensure that there is continued sustainable, effective and affordable supply of energy to this economy. Was this expressed explicitly in the past? Perhaps not.
And the problem is, if you don't express it explicitly, then you don't have clear programs to ensure it. When you put it like this, what it does, it forces the minister, the department, to look at all and identify all the risks that are inherent in the system and come up with risk mitigation strategies. It also says, in the event that there is no supply of energy, the public outlet out there will hold one person accountable for it. As long as there is no one who is accountable for something, it will not be done. It's not a them, you know, it always becomes, I was expecting that they will do this. The expectation is that you will do this. But you never told me that if I don't do this, my head will roar. And that's what this is about. How realistic is it? As we speak today, unfortunately not so realistic. In the sense that, but to make it realistic, you need to set it, all the things, all the things, it sets a vision, an end state, a desired end state, and it should force all of us to then say, we need to come up with activities and programs and strategies that will take us to that end state. Some of that is about reserve margins. For instance, in terms of electricity, you need to have reserve margins. Reserve margin both in terms of the production capacity, in terms of the plants that you have, but also in terms of making sure that you've got coal stocks. Unfortunately, as I indicated, in our framework, that's insurance. You need to take that insurance. But also, as I've indicated, insurance comes at a cost. Someone needs to pay for that insurance. And the question is, who should? But someone needs to make sure that insurance is available. I'm sure, Honorable Chair, the expectation is that even if there was to be a war in Iraq, that I'm sure you do expect this government to have thought about that and to have said, if there is, how do we make sure that in this country we don't run out of fuel? At least for a reasonable period. Not for an extended 12 months or 24 month period, but for a reasonable period. And that's what that objective is about. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I realize that it's 12 o'clock, and I'm sure that you have done a lot of work around this area. Like Honorable Comrigue said, you have, your team has put a lot of work in putting together this brief, and we think we will go through this point by point, clause by clause, and make sure that we comprehend, understand it, such that when we participate in the process of the bill, we will be doing justice to expectations of stakeholders, expectations of interest groups, communities, and everybody, such that when we finish with the bill, then we've done a good work too. So it means you have empowered us as a department, and we think we can, we've got evidence, we've got sufficient information to proceed. I don't want to close without saying that if the state law advisor has anything to say, then he can raise some issues, but I'm sure that as the process unfolds, she will be part of processes. An opportunity will arise tomorrow. I think today, as we make presentations with the community here, tomorrow with public hearings, stakeholders coming, the 31st and the 5th, such that when we complete the process, then we should be convinced that we've done a good job. So I think without much ado, I want to thank the department for making this telling good, powerful contribution. The DDG, do you want to say something before we close?
No, Chairperson, thank you.
Matsiho?
Thanks, Chair. I think our DDG has covered us. Thanks. Thank you.
Super.
Thanks, Chair. I think you know, we would like to engage more on this bill, and especially to see, you know, it go through. I think comments on this bill will help to improve that process, and I think we appreciate that.
Now, the only thing we can say is our apologies that we didn't give you 4 hours or 10 hours. We tried our little best to accommodate you as much as possible. I just want to thank you. Maybe we can now have a 5 minute break. Then from there we can allow a presentation. And the department is... as it's invited, you don't have to leave. But if you have pressing commitments, you can. But it's important that the department should listen to the views of the community. Then, so can you have 5 minutes break?
I'm going to go to the next one. Thank you.